Hey, I'm Jeremy Loeb with WCQS News. You're about to hear an interview with Representative Brian Turner. He's a Democrat representing Buncombe County. He's in his second term in the North Carolina legislature.
Representative Brian Turner, thanks for coming back in. Always good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. I love coming in and talking to you guys.
In this latest round of interviews I've done with people, we've sort of introduced some of the newer lawmakers, and so it's sort of been a chance to get to know people. I know that in the past, when we've spoken to you, we haven't really gone into your background. Do you mind just telling our listeners some a bit about your background of how you got going into politics and things like that?
Sure. Prior to running for office in 14, I had never really been politically active. Just sort of been living my life here in Buncombe County with my wife and daughter. And really what happened was I was working at UNC Asheville. I was the assistant vice chancellor for corporate relations and charged with getting businesses engaged with the university, as well as overseeing the Family Business Forum and Leadership Asheville. And on numerous occasions, then Chancellor Ponder had meetings, sort of state of the university meetings, we used to call them, and talking about the belt tightening that was happening with the university system and the budget cuts. And I remember her in one meeting sort of talking in a positive way about how UNC Asheville had been cut less than other schools in the system. And to me, that was very sort of concerning that we were happy that we just weren't being cut as much. And so when I looked at what was going on at the state level in terms of public education, I really felt like we were going in the wrong direction. So that's when I decided to step forward and run for office.
Oh, okay. Was that a difficult decision for you?
It was very difficult. I talked to my wife and my family. I talked to the chancellor and, you know, really wanted to make sure that I was doing the right thing, wanted to make sure that I was going to, that I stood a good chance of being successful in it, and really tried to gain a better understanding of what all was going to be involved in the campaign process in particular, and sort of the slings and arrows that might come my way and eventually did, and whether or not it would be worth it.
And what's your professional background?
Educationally, I've got an undergraduate degree from Northwestern in economics and an MBA from Wake Forest. So that's sort of my educational background. Mm-hmm. Professionally, my first career was in television production. I spent about 10 years working for MTV, starting off at MTV News, and then moving on to doing their live shows like the Video Music Awards. Worked for a while in my family's business and manufacturing here in Asheville before moving into higher education.
What years were you working with MTV?
So I was with MTV from about 96 to 2004, and then did some work on and off for them a couple of years, sort of right after that, in New York and in Los Angeles. I mean, it was a tremendous experience. I think that there are two shows that I was able to be a part of the production team. One was an AIDS benefit concert we did down in South Africa, down in Cape Town, which was tremendous. And the other one was that following 9/11, we did a concert with the USO at Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany in December of 2001. So it was there to help support the troops who were flying back and forth to Afghanistan following 9/11.
Oh, okay. And what did you do with MTV News?
With MTV News, so my very first job with MTV was I was a van driver when MTV News came out to cover the Democratic Convention in Chicago. So I had just graduated from school and knew the city, and for $75 a day, I drove a van back and forth from hotels, eventually working my way up to becoming a line producer with them, helping some of their longer form shows, True Life, things like that.
And where was that?
That was in New York.
Oh, okay, New York. Yeah. Gotcha. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up here.
Yeah,
I grew up here. You know, my dad and mom met at McCormick Field at a tourist game back in the 50s. And though I had the misfortune, I guess, maybe, of being born not here in Asheville, but in Georgia. We moved back when I was at a very young age. I was about 4 or 5. And so I grew up here in Weaverville and North Asheville area.
Oh, I see. Okay. And what was your childhood like?
Like, I guess, any other sort of kid who grows up in the mountains, it was filled with, you know, hiking and fishing. You know, my dad worked a lot, traveled a lot, but my mom was very supportive of things, of my sister and I, and really had a wonderful childhood. My dad would be home. We would do things like we'd go out to like Rocky Fork and Devil's Fork and go out to Madison County, go fishing, visit some of the old family home places, the old family farm, and really just sort of grew up here in the mountains. And I mean, and that's what I'm trying to do now for my daughter is have her have all those experiences. We go hunting and fishing here in the mountains. We go canoeing down the French Broad. And I mean, this is such a fantastic place to live. And that's one of the things that, you know, getting involved with politics and, you know, working for environmental protections, it's sort of, you know, I grew up on these mountains. I remember what they were like when they were dirtier, when the rivers were dirty, when the air was dirty. And so now we've got them cleaned up. I'd like to keep it that way.
Are you worried about where we're heading as far as environmental protections?
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress over the past few years and decades. The Clean Smokestacks Act that Senator Nesbitt helped get passed and then Governor Cooper enforced. I think that with Governor Cooper coming in and being able to appoint some new folks to Department of Environmental Quality, formerly Diener, that we'll see better and more consistent enforcement of regulations. I know that there's been a lot of talk about coal ash. We've got good coal ash cleanup happening down in South Asheville, down at the Lake Julian plant. Duke Energy has stepped up there. We're talking about also putting permanent water supplies in for a lot of folks who are affected by that down there. And I appreciate the work Duke has done and working on that and some of the things that they've done beyond what they've been required to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they've been a pretty good partner for some of that. But we have to be vigilant, and we've always got to be on the lookout, and we've got to make sure that we're not hurting some of the things we've done in the past. You know, we got to keep in place the air quality monitors that we've had in the past. We've got to make sure that we're doing water sampling. We're keeping control of bacteria and pollution plumes that we see in the French Broad River. I mean, it's no longer the old days of, you know, when the denim mill up the road was working, the river turned blue, but we want to make sure we don't get close to that.
So it sounds like growing up, you weren't super political or anything like that, and it seems like education kind of drove you. And
well, I did run for student body president in eighth grade.
Oh, okay.
And won. And then I ran for vice president of student body in high school and won. So I've got a pretty good track record, I guess. But, you know, that was more about, can we get, you know, Kool-Aid in the water fountains and, you know, and get McDonald's to cater the cafeteria.
Easier issues to run on back
but
then.
But no, but like but through college, through my adult life, I was never involved politically. I've never really got engaged until, you know, I was able to see it firsthand what some of the effects. And I think that, you know, now as part of my job as being a state representative, one of the things I really try and do is get out as much as I possibly can in the community and working with state agencies to better understand the impacts of the policies, better understand how the state works, how the state agencies work, so that I can be a better representative and be more engaged.
You seem to have been a pretty effective legislator from the standpoint of being in the minority party. I don't know how accurate these rankings are, but, you know, there was someone that put out a ranking of effective legislators, and you're pretty high up there, at least in terms of Democrats. And so you are a Democrat, but you seem to be someone who's works across the aisle with ease.
I mean, I'm a pretty moderate Democrat, I guess, as far as Democrats go. So I see and understand and find some common ground with a lot of my Republican colleagues. But I guess my preferred way of working is, you know, I don't do a lot of floor speeches. I don't stand up and get out there with a lot of rhetoric and a lot of some of the more inflammatory statements that you might hear or see, because I look at my goal is to try and make the people I represent, my goal is to make their lives better. You know, if I can get them better jobs, if I can help them be healthier, if I can help them live in a cleaner environment, you know, that's my goal. And sometimes the best way to do that is to just to be quietly working behind the scenes and not with the inflammatory Facebook posts or the floor speeches. You know, I think some of those things are important because we want people to hear what's going on. But I just my preferred way of working is a little more collaborative and sort of quiet behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we look forward to this coming session, let's take a look at what happened during the special sessions and just give me your take on what occurred. You know, we had three.
Right. It's hard to keep track of them all.
Yeah. So first we had the disaster relief.
Right. Yes. We had disaster relief, which was great. We came down, we voted and passed provisions to give access to financial aid and well as other resources across the state for Hurricane Matthew relief, as well as the wildfires out west, which was critical. I remember driving through Princeville down near Tarboro, gosh, even back in December, and still the devastation was obvious. And you'd see just these huge mounds of debris piled up at the end of roads of things that had been washed out of people's houses or dumped out because they were ruined, entire communities relocated. So that was critical to do. You know, obviously in the West, we had our own problem with sort of our first, I think, sort of experience what you'd kind of considered California-style wildfires, just large, multiple ones. We saw what happened in Sevierville, the tragedies there. And so the western region, eastern Tennessee, really was, you know, was dramatically impacted. But we did that session, and we got that done, and that was great. I think that we saw what was a little bit disingenuous is that immediately upon adjourning that special session, we jumped right into a new one. And that new one were the efforts made to sort of diminish the authority and the role of the governor's office.
It's almost silly to call them separate sessions because you were there, something was passed, and then immediately another session took place. And I think maybe the stated goal of separating those two was to separate a very contentious political issue from the disaster relief. But it could also be to give political cover is kind of what it appeared to me. It was like, you know, we did this one session, but now we're going to separate this from another one.
I think there was definitely an effort to be able to say, hey, look, we came down for this special session for hurricane relief, and that's what we did. So if you look at it from a truly technical perspective, yes, that special session was solely for its called purpose of hurricane and wildfire relief, and we did not take up any other business. To then jump immediately into a second or third or fourth, I can't remember which number again, yeah, special session following is a little bit of, I guess my perspective of special session is, it's something that is of a critical nature, something that has to happen. Again, wildfire relief. This is money that we needed to get set aside and support we needed to get into place to help people who were impacted and were suffering. Now, to talk about the role of the authority of Department of Public Instruction, to talk about the governor's ability to appoint people to the University Board of Trustees and Board of Governors, that to me is not a critical piece of legislation. That's not something that we had to deal with right then and there. And I think we should have waited to come back into general session, long session, so that we could have a thorough debate. The public could have opportunity to weigh in. The new governor who is coming in would have an opportunity to weigh in. But we didn't. We rushed through it. And I think that we are seeing consistently that when we rush into these things, it leads to problems.
And you had no idea that this second session would be called?
No, no. There had been rumblings that legislation might come forward to remove some authority from the governor's office, but there are rumors that happen about a lot of things. And so when the session adjourned and then immediately came back in as a new one, it was a surprise to a lot of folks.
Has that been normal during your time that legislation and the plans of leadership has been kept from members of the legislature? I don't know if it's all the legislature or if it's just the Democrats.
Well, I really haven't. It's funny, kind of funny when we got done with our last special session, which was the attempt to repeal House Bill 2, and knowing that we were coming back in for the long session in a couple of weeks, it sort of felt like the legislative session never ended. And this being my first term, this is all I know. So I understand that what we saw was historic in terms of the number of special sessions and what was taken up. But, I don't know if this is par for the course in terms of keeping people isolated in terms of information. I hope not. I think that when you work in darkness, I feel like dark things are the product.
Well, when you look at what was passed in terms of the governor's powers and some of the changes that took place, were you entirely opposed, or were there some things in there that you thought were okay?
I was not in support of that legislation. I think to try and make those changes for an incoming administration, in advance of an incoming administration, I think is, I guess maybe I call it poor sportsmanship. I mean, it's not a game, but I struggle for a metaphor. But Governor Cooper won the election, and now we're going to change the job description. And that's a good way of looking at it. It's this idea of the voters of North Carolina had a job description for governor, and they had two potential candidates. And they said, you know what, given what the job description is for governor, this is the guy we want to hire. And now what basically we've done is we hire this guy, and then someone comes in and says, well, you know what, that's not the job description anymore. And that's true for the governor's office. It's true for the head of DPI, the state superintendent. You know, you hire someone saying, here's what June Atkinson has been doing. Here's what Dr. Atkinson has been doing for the past 12 years. And you have this expectation that that's what the job you're hiring somebody for is going to be. And then you hire that person and someone says, well, it wasn't this job, it was this job plus all these other additional responsibilities. Well, gosh, if we had known that, maybe we wouldn't have hired that guy. It's a little bit of a bait and switch, I think, on the people of North Carolina. We hired Governor Cooper because this was the job. And now you've gone and changed the job. We hired a state superintendent because this was the job. Now you've gone and changed the job. I think that's a real problem to do that. I think it's a bait and switch, and I wish we hadn't done it.
Yeah, and Republicans point out that Cooper won by so few votes, but yet at the same time, he won in a year when Republicans did pretty well across the state. I mean, with Donald Trump's win and Richard Burr's win.
And I find that to be somewhat curious. You know, sort of like I think back to the old days of the college football rankings where teams would run up the score because if you blew somebody out, it actually improved your chances of getting a higher ranking. But it's this idea of because you didn't win by a large margin, therefore your win is not as legitimate. Do we really want to get into talking about popular votes and margins of victory and what is legitimate and what's not? But really to say, oh, Governor Cooper won by a slim margin, therefore his office is somewhat diminished. I don't believe people think that truly in their hearts.
This is a tough question, but why do you think Democrats didn't do better? You know, obviously you had Cooper's win, Mike Morgan's win at the state Supreme Court, and of course the attorney general as well. But the goal, the stated goal coming in was, let's try to win a few seats so that if Cooper wins, you know, we can at least get the veto-proof majority away. Was it just the national stuff that was going on, or what do you think?
Well, it's hard for me to speak beyond my race, and I was unopposed on the ballot this year. But I work hard all year long, not just in campaign years, to be out in the community, to have town hall meetings, to sit down with folks across the table, to sit with them at lunch, invite people to come and meet with me, to do those things so that I can understand what's going on with the folks in my district. And I think that's part of what we need to get back to. It's not about Facebook likes. It's about, have you actually gone out to the communities that are being affected and understand what's going on? You know, when I go out into Sandy Mush and I go meet with a dairy farmer, or I go out and meet with somebody out there who's trying to get a job because they lost their construction job, you know, 10 years ago, you know, that's something you're not going to get through a tweet. That's something you've got to work to understand what's going on and to be out there. And I'm not perfect and I don't understand everything, but you've got to get out there and at least try to connect beyond a telephone poll, a poll being done on the phone.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that we get away from that and we rely on polling, or you rely on Facebook likes, or you rely on stuff you read in the media. And there's no substitute for just being out active in your community and giving people the chance to talk to you casually. And I think that's part of what we've lost, not just as Democrats, but as public officials in general. With the attacks and the harsh criticism that comes, it's easy to wall yourself off and say, I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to listen to it. I'm only going to watch Fox, or I'm only going to watch MSNBC, or I'm only going to go to the places where people like me and know me. You know, you got to stretch yourself. You got to get out there. You got to move beyond your comfort zone because, you know, that's what people expect.
Speaking about the way our districts are drawn, we aren't really incentivizing that level of discourse, I don't think, with our elected officials. They seem to be, you know, really protected for the most part. But you, had you had an opponent, would have likely been in a tough election. And so you're in one of those interesting districts where you do actually have to compete.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think it's good. And I think competition is good. Mm-hmm. I wish more districts across the state were competitive. If I've got to work every year to keep this job, that's a good thing for the people I represent. If I'm in a district that's a safe district for me and I can rest on my laurels and I don't have to worry about it, that's not good. So, you know, competitive districts, you know, non-gerrymandered districts, that's going to be better for the people in North Carolina.
Well, getting back to the special sessions, you know, then there was the third one that we had, a third special session dealing with House Bill 2. You were in the House. Of course, the breakdown really occurred in the Senate because that was where the legislation was really being actively discussed. But what was your perception over the breakdown that occurred?
I think that there was some inherent distrust that existed between Democrats, between Republicans, between the House, between the Senate, between the General Assembly and Charlotte. And I think that the bargain that had been brought to the table and had been structured was really truly just held together with sort of, you know, baling wire and duct tape. And when there was any opportunity for a crack to appear, the whole thing just was unraveled. And I think that whether it was true or not, and I don't think it was, you know, Charlotte repealed the ordinance and there was concern that Charlotte didn't go far enough. So they come back into session and they make sure that that's a full repeal of their ordinance so that we can move forward with this repeal of House Bill 2, this much needed repeal of House Bill 2. And then, you know, that happens, but it just gave, I think, just enough of an incentive for a number of people to break off and say, oh, we don't trust them. I think it was just a lot of pressure brought at the end of the year when folks were tired and it just, it didn't hold together. Yeah. I wish it had. We need to get rid of House Bill 2. I'll tell you something. It's interesting. About 2 weeks ago, I was at a commercial real estate conference. That's my day job, commercial real estate. And Sarah Quinn, who's the senior vice president of market insights and analysis for MasterCard. She doesn't live in North Carolina. She has no dog in this fight. And she stood on stage in front of a couple thousand people in Raleigh at the PNC Center and said, y'all got to get rid of House Bill 2 because it's going to kill your economy. And to hear somebody like that who, they don't care whether House Bill 2 exists or not, mm-hmm. but to show how, you know, how it's affecting business, how it's affecting the data that's coming through, the economic data, and you know, we got to get rid of it. We, you know, we've got to restore some sensibility to what we allow our local governments to do. You know, our city council, our county commission, you know, they're elected by us also. And we expect them to do things. Mm-hmm. And if city council or county commission passes an ordinance or something like that that we don't like, we can vote them out. But it's hard when you've got folks who are in far reaches of the state and other areas coming down hard on cities. You know, they don't represent those populations. So it's tough. And House Bill 2 just needs to go.
Do you see any possibility of that? It seems already that there is conflicting statements. The governor says the votes are there. Senator Berger says the votes aren't there. And he doesn't think that a clean repeal is possible. Do you think that the votes are there for a clean repeal if you add up the Democrats and you add up the Republicans who want to get rid of it too?
Yes.
Yes. Definitely.
I think that if a full repeal of House Bill 2 were brought to the floor, that there would be enough votes for repeal. If everyone would just sort of hold their finger wagging and their tongue lashing and their grandstanding for 24 hours, I think we could get it done.
About the Senate as well? You think that there could be the votes there as well?
That's a harder thing. That's probably a better question for Senator Van Dyne. But I think that there's enough folks in the House to do what we need to do. And I don't want to try and silence anybody who wants to be critical or speak up or things like that. But sometimes, again, if we just work diligently and can get something done without saying, I told you so, we can probably get it done.
You think even some of the people that you agree with, that when they get up and say something, that sometimes it has a damaging effect on the cohesiveness of the body?
I think so. I mean, I know that there are folks on my side of the aisle and on the other side of the aisle that I've heard people tell me, they say, well, when so-and-so gets up to talk and speak in favor of something, it immediately makes me want to vote against it because I know who they are and what they stand for and this and that. And I mean, we're human beings and we get upset and we don't like it when our values are challenged or when we're called names or it's insinuated that, you know, someone's a racist or a misogynist or this or that. Those, that kind of name calling doesn't, I don't think, do anybody any good necessarily, especially when we're trying to be a deliberative body and get something done. It probably sounds like I'm trying to silence folks, but I don't. I just sometimes wish that we could get past the inflaming rhetoric and actually get down to business and repeal House Bill 2. That's what we need to do. I mean, that's the goal. And if you're not working toward that, you know, you're not helping North Carolina.
Well, let's look forward a little bit to this session. What are some of the priorities that you have for this upcoming long session?
Typically, my focus would be on support of public education. I mean, that's something that, again, that's something that got me into politics, into public service, and that's K through 16. So that's critical. We want to make sure we're doing everything we can to protect the mountains and rivers out here in Western North Carolina. So, and not just Western North Carolina, but across the state. You know, I spent some time down near the Outer Banks, down near Lake Matamuskeet this year, and they have needs as well. And then we've also got to worry about jobs, about bringing good jobs back. And we do talk about things like repealing House Bill 2, you know, bringing companies back, making them feel comfortable coming back. But beyond sort of those sort of foundational core issues that I would always like to focus on, there are really sort of three other ones that I'm going to be focusing on. One is going to be rural connectivity, improving access to broadband as well as cellular systems. I mean, you can go out into Sandy Mush and you can't get internet. You can't get a cell phone signal, or you can get internet, but it's satellite. And so we've got to worry about, you know, there's access issues. Can I get it? And then there's capability issues. If I can get it, is it enough to actually do anything? You know, is it you know, 10 megabits? Is it 2 megabits? What is it? And then there's an affordability issue that goes with it too. How much is it going to cost me? I mean, I can get, I think, 5 megabit download satellite internet out in Sandy Mush with a 10 gigabyte data cap for $60 a month. And it's not fast enough that I can stream video.
What do you think some of the solutions are to that?
We need to look at how does the county and the state, federal and private sector work together. So how do we create an environment where it's worth AT&T or Verizon's while to bring fiber out that way, or to bring cable out that way? Are there opportunities for high-speed wireless, Skyrunner type stuff from some of the mountain peaks? You know, we have to look at, I think, a series of ways to get there. You know, right now I'm working with a group out in Sandy Mush and with AT&T just to try and bring high speed to the Sandy Mush Community Center. Let's at least bring it to the community center so that people don't have to drive into, you know, McDonald's on Patton Avenue to get a wireless signal to do their homework, or drive into the library to fill out a job application. I mean, that's what we talk about. You talk about jobs. You talk about the fact that, you know, there's not a job out there really anymore that you can get, a career job, that you don't fill out an application online. And if you can't get online to fill out that job application, how are you supposed to get that job? So rural connectivity is something I'm really going to be pushing for. I'm on the IT Appropriations Committee this year, so I'm hoping I can make some inroads there. I've talked to Congressman Meadows about this in the past, and he's supportive of these efforts. So how do we combine it all together?
It does seem like this will be a bipartisan issue. Some of the people that I've talked to before who were Republicans were speaking about the same issue also. Is this something where you think that all the Western lawmakers will sort of come together to try to support this effort? Is this also an issue that's on the eastern part of the state?
It's a big problem. Yeah, the eastern part of the state is affected as well. Some of the things they've got are a little bit easier because it's flat. So you can put up a tower and it'll reach a lot further than if you put up a tower on Doggett Mountain. But it does affect the east. I've talked to Representative McGrady about this. He has some of the same issues for the area he covers. I'm hoping to talk to Representative Clampett about it and some of the other folks out west, you know, to see how do we leverage that. I know it's hard for some folks to understand. I guess it's one of those things where, again, you got to get out and understand how it really affects people. If you're a lawmaker in Raleigh or you're a lawmaker in downtown Charlotte, it's really hard to understand that someone who lives 10 miles outside the city limits of Asheville can't get online.
It's something you take for granted when you're here.
You know, you wake up in the morning and you turn on your computer and you check your email and you watch a funny YouTube video and this and that, and then you go to work. Well, this is like, I wake up in the morning and, you know, maybe I'll drive down to the community center and check my email, or I'll take my child into town so they can upload their homework. I mean, it's a different world, but I'm hoping with bipartisan support, we can get some traction forward. And again, it's access, it's capability, and it's affordability.
Yeah.
You know, you really got to work on those three things, with affordability being a big part of it. I mean, you figure if you're paying, you know, you're paying $60, $70 a month without taxes and fees, you're getting close to $1,000 a year to get online. And I'm sorry, but not being able to get online in this world is going to hold people back. It's going to hold people back from getting jobs. It's going to hold people back from starting businesses, from getting education. You know, we talk about people being able to take courses online. Well, you can't do that if you can't get online.
And how much legwork has been done on this issue already? I mean, it seems like the kind of thing that you would think had already been addressed. And why didn't it in the last session?
Representative Jason Sain from Lincolnton has done some work on it. He's the one that actually I approached about being added to his committee so that I could work on it for the Western region. He's been doing some good work on it. I think Department of Commerce did a study about rural broadband or connectivity. Some of the information I talks about, it seems to focus on access. And again, there's a difference between being able to access broadband, what the true capabilities and what the costs are. Because it's like sort of like, sure, I can get online, but if I can't afford it, I may as well not have it. And if I, you know, in my house, I can get like 25 megabits download for as much as someone out, you know, deep in Leicester is going to pay to get 5 megabits download. You know, that's just, again, do they have access? Yeah. Is it meaningful, affordable access? No, not really.
Well, so that's one issue. You were mentioning two others that you had.
So another one is what's going on with the prescription drug and opioid abuse in our region. Last year, I talked to Sheriff Van Duncan about this issue, also participated in a town hall that WLOS did surrounding this issue. I think the Citizen Times just recently did an article about the level of prescriptions that we're seeing for painkillers in Western North Carolina and Buncombe County. And you know, and we're seeing this pattern, not just here in Buncombe County, but across the state of somebody hurts their back. They get a prescription for Vicodin. You know, they take a handful of pills and it sits in their medicine cabinet. You know, teenage kid gets it or they get hooked on it. And then it progresses and becomes then all of a sudden heroin. Yeah. I can't get my Vicodin because I don't have a prescription anymore. So now I'm going to go out and search for what I can get. Couple of things we need to deal with in this issue. One is, I think we need to look at how, as a state and with Medicaid and Medicare and with our health system, how we're approaching pain management. Yes, there's a place for opioids and for those types of painkillers, but what about alternative therapies, acupuncture, chiropractic, massage, medical marijuana? What are some other things that are out there that we could be moving forward to give people alternatives? So that's one. Number two is, you know, restricting access to some of these drugs and focusing more on prevention and then on treatment. I know Sheriff Van Duncan has done a lot to try and help, I don't want to say decriminalize, that's not the right word, but to basically show the addiction for what it is. That's an addiction, and it's somebody that needs to be treated medically, you know, and not necessarily incarcerated.
Right.
I mean, obviously, yes, there are times when that needs to happen. Someone's dealing, there are extreme cases, but for the most part, it's about getting people help. So how do we deal with this opioid addiction issue? My third big focus is going to be access to affordable childcare and childcare subsidies. We have reimbursement rates for childcare that are based off of the cost of childcare in Buncombe County. Well, one of the problems we have with Buncombe County is that we've got a number of great nonprofits, Mountain Area Child and Family Center, YWCA, things like that, that are providing robust childcare at a discounted price because it's a nonprofit. But then their pricing is factored into the state reimbursement rates for childcare subsidies. So we've almost artificially depressed, so you can't get people coming into to this area because they can't get the reimbursement rates. It's a weird sort of vicious cycle that we're seeing in this area. But, you know, you think about more and more families are two income families. I think just about everybody is at this point. But now it's not just two incomes, but it's like we're two incomes, but four job families. And so being able to have access to that childcare, being able to, for a mom or a dad to be able to, you know, drop their kids off so they can go to work and they can afford to do that is critical. And again, this all goes to the whole thing of what are we doing to help people move forward, or are we holding them back? If you can't get online, you can't access our sort of modern economy. If you can't have a place where your child can be taken care of while you go to work, you can't take that job. And so these are all part of this tapestry of issues that I think that are really holding the people of Western North Carolina back. And it's detrimental to a lot of the rural areas and keeping them from moving forward.
Yeah, you're talking about really basic needs.
Yeah.
And as far as the opioid issue, I know that the new Attorney General, Josh Stein, is working on that. Senator Jim Davis was talking about that as well. So it sounds like all of these issues that you're focus on taking up are ones that have support on both sides of the aisle and could potentially go through.
Well, and I'm encouraged that Senator Davis, I know, and Representative Horn as well, and I spoke to Representative Horn last week when we were in Raleigh about working on this issue with him. Of course, Attorney General Stein, who I think is going to do a great job, it's moving beyond seeing opioid addiction as, again, as being purely criminal. I had a conversation last year with some pharmaceutical folks. And I said, How is it that instead of dealing with opioid problems, y'all are just inventing new drugs to deal with the constipation created by opioid abuse? You know, it's sort of the OIC drugs out there. I was like, that's not helping.
Right.
And they've got their, you know, there are some people who are on, you know, those kind of drugs long term and they have these problems. But again, it's like, it just makes me feel like we don't care sometimes if people are abusing these drugs. We're just going to create new drugs to help them keep abusing.
I've been hearing a lot also about the raise the age effort too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think it's great.
You think, the idea of raising the age would be good?
Oh yes.
And we're talking about, you know, some of the same people probably.
Right. You know? And it's basically increasing the age of individuals are charged in terms of are they charged as adults or charged as children.
Yeah.
I know District Attorney Todd Williams is very in support of this. Our new Family Justice Center here in Buncombe County is in support of this, as well as a number of legislators across the state. And again, it gets to this point of, you know, should 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds be serving serious jail terms? I mean, I'm sorry, but I think of some of the things I did when I was 15 and 16 years old, and it's sort of like, you know, if I'd gotten caught doing some of them, you know, Lord knows. Mom, I hope you're not listening.
Careful now.
Yeah, but it's that idea of you know, you can have two people in similar circumstances. One has the bad luck.
Yeah.
To get caught, the other one doesn't. This one goes to jail, or this one gets a slap on the wrist or whatever, and it changes people's lives dramatically.
Right. And then, of course, you know, some people, you know, come from a background of privilege where they'll have the resources to get out of some stupid mistake that they've made.
Right.
Whereas someone else will get swept up into the system and end up staying there for a while.
I think there's a noted and documented racial component to that.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, I think you also start to look at the like you say, the socioeconomic aspect of it too. It's, do I have the money to hire a lawyer or not? And that's unfortunate. My grandma used to run the juvenile detention center out on Lees Creek Road, out by the Irwin High School. And so as a kid, I spent a lot of time over there. You know, and there are a lot of kids who, this is where they'd go to in between being arrested and awaiting trial. And you talk to some of these kids, and a lot of them are just, you know, they're scared runaways because they're running away from abusive households, or they shoplifted something on a dare, or they did a lot of just stupid things. Mm-hmm. Now, there were some legit criminals there too, but it's sort of this idea of, you know, do we want to start incarcerating children like this? Or do we want to keep doing it as maybe a better thing? And there's better ways to spend our dollars. There's better ways to help people move through a rough period of their life and move forward with their life. So raising the age, I think, would be something that's long past its due.
And tell me a little bit about your district. You represent South Asheville and then Buncombe County, of course.
Right. So sort of casually, I would say I represent Skyland to Sandy Mush. It's all sort of western and southwestern Buncombe County. So the only part of the city of Asheville I represent is really kind of the stripped down Hendersonville Road and the airport, Biltmore Park. All the rest of it's county, Lester, Anka Candler, Sandy Mush, Avery's Creek, Bent Creek, Arden.
So these issues that you're talking about, these are some of the issues that are really facing your district, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that Representative Ager and Representative Fisher would agree that it's not just my district. I think it's Buncombe County and the Western region. Representative Fisher's district obviously is predominantly the city of Asheville. And so some of the challenges that folks face in those areas can be a little bit different. But I think that we can all kind of agree on what we need to do.
Well, not to get us too far off topic, but you know, you're going to be going to Raleigh, you know, tomorrow and this long session. There's also this climate of uncertainty nationally going on with the new president. And of course, this weekend was pretty dramatic with all the immigration stuff going on. I guess, you know, just sort of broadly, how are you feeling about what's going on in the country and in the state? And also, how do you, as a legislator, keep your focus where you believe it needs to be?
For starters, I think that when government is thoughtful and methodical in their approach, and some people might see it as being inefficient, but I think that when we look at things like House Bill 2, passed in a day, signed into law in a 12-hour period, and we see that the problems that has caused, when we see executive orders that are rushed through the process, not being properly vetted by agencies, we see the chaos and the danger that they present. And it's unconscionable what we saw occurring over the weekend, and I hope that something positive can happen. And I applaud everybody who is working to try and make those changes and to roll back some of these executive orders and change who we are in the eyes of the world. As an American, I worry about our country. As someone who lives here, someone who's born here, grew up here, as a state legislator, I really focus on what is our state doing? What are the things that I can control? What are the things that I can affect? And so, you know, so that's why I really try and sit there and say, okay, you know, what's going on in my district? What is affecting the day-to-day lives of the people that I represent in Raleigh? And how do I make progress on those issues? It's not to minimize the challenges that we see at the national level, but my responsibility is first to the folks in my district at the state level.
Yeah, but it was interesting. You saw a direct contrast between what the legislature did with House Bill 2 and just basically drawing a parallel with, you know,
it's
the rushed nature of certain things.
Haste makes waste. When you jump to decisions, when you jump to conclusions, and I think we see this all the time, and I think with the spread of social media, it's gotten worse. Someone shows a video clip or a photo, or someone creates a statistic out of, you know, thin air, and everyone jumps on it. And it's like, folks, let's let it sit for 24, 36, 48 hours. You know, there was a shooting at a mosque in Canada overnight. And there are people on social media already talking about conspiracies, talking about this, talking about that, talking about the root cause of it. It's like, guys, we don't know anything yet. Let's all just take a collective breath and figure out before we start to jump to any conclusions about what the cause was, what the motives were. And I think that if we can do that a little bit better, you know, House Bill 2 is a perfect example. We rush into it. You could almost say that the repeal of House Bill 2 was similar. We kind of rushed into that. And so if we can take our time, be a little more methodical, open ourselves up to debate, open ourselves up to different perspectives, give the public a chance to weigh in on these issues, give people who have the experience and the knowledge a chance to weigh in on these issues, then I think we'll be a lot better. And it won't be so much about court battles and coming up with last-minute fixes. Let's do the hard work of working out the details and thinking this through on the front end.
Yeah.
It's not sexy. It doesn't grab a whole lot of headlines. It doesn't, you know, probably make your reelection chances as good, but it's actually better governing.
You're a father. What are you telling your kids to try to help them navigate this climate that we're in?
Oh, gosh. So I have a daughter. She's 9, Eleanor. She's awesome. And she gets dragged to way too many things with me sometimes. This past weekend, we were at celebrating the Korean New Year with the Korean Association of Asheville on Saturday night and talking about some of these issues with folks. And
I'm sure that was her first choice for things she wanted to do.
It was absolutely. Absolutely. Like, yeah. We could go see a movie, or we could go to the Lunar New Year celebration. She's like, oh, Dad, Lunar New Year. Absolutely. Hands down.
I bet it was pretty fun, though.
It was fun. It was fun. But it was very interesting to be in that room, which is, you know, it's a lot of Korean immigrants, and there are a lot of Korean War veterans, and to see the immigrant community thanking the veterans for their work, for their service, for their sacrifice, and helping keep them free. Those are some positive things I get to share with my daughter about how when America is supportive of its allies, when we step forward in the world, when we're an active participant, that our allies are supported and stronger, we're stronger, the world's safer. When we withdraw, I think the inverse happens. But a lot of times when there are things happening on the news, and a lot of times she'll say, Dad, you need to stop watching. But I try and educate her as to why I believe some of the things that are happening are bad or wrong, and what I'm doing to try and make things better. I try to educate her on what things that other people are doing to make things better. But I think really more important, Jeremy, it's tough because there are things I want to share with her as a father, but, you know, I see and hear a lot of this stuff and I get very cynical about it sometimes. And so I don't sugarcoat it for her. When she asks me things about, you know, President Trump, should we be afraid? And I will be honest with her and I'll say, I don't know yet. And she has a lot of friends from other countries, and she's worried about them.
And that's not a fun thing that you have to tell your daughter, that you don't know that we're safe or something like that.
And I don't want to scare her.
Right.
But I also don't want to, you know, the world is, can be a scary place, and it can be a place full of uncertainty. And I want her to understand that if she wants her friends to be safe, if she wants us to be a stronger, better community, that we've got to do something.
How do you think she's responding to it? Do you think she's handling it okay so far?
Yeah, she surprises me sometimes. Mm-hmm. with her insights. And she surprises me sometimes when she tells me that it's going to be okay.
So sometimes she's a source of comfort for you.
Yeah. But she understands that there's a lot of inequality in this world and in our community, and that it cuts across religious and racial and cultural lines. And for her, I'm trying to teach her that it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, what you believe, that, you know, we all deserve to be treated with respect. And we all deserve a shot.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, when Trump won the election, I'm getting way off topic, but, yeah. You know, I saw that quote by Van Jones when he was on CNN. He was talking about, you know, we've just had someone elected who had kind of bullied his way into getting elected. What do we say to our kids who we've been preaching to that this is not good, when we've just basically seen the country kind of reward that behavior? And, you know, not getting into the very genuine reasons that people would vote for Donald Trump, but of course there was this stuff that was going on. Do our kids listen to us less when we tell them that this isn't the way to act?
You know, when President Trump was elected, I mean, there's been a lot of teeth gnashing about it and everything. But because Eleanor comes with me when I do a lot of things on the weekends and things like that, And we have friends, and you know, I've got a friend of mine, Mike. Mike mm-hmm. lives out Leicester way, big Trump supporter. You know, you sit down, you have breakfast with Mike, and you talk to him, and you get it. And you understand. And by giving her the ability to sit down with somebody who can talk through why they voted the way they did or why they supported the way they did, you know, it makes her understand better why. Yeah. And that's different than what she sees on TV with CNN or Fox or MSNBC covering the president. There's a difference between covering the president and what he's doing and understanding the people who supported him and why.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's a big difference. But when you see the bullying and things like that, and you can juxtapose that with the protests and the marches and things like that, I think it's a great lesson. It's that even when someone is elected to the highest office of the world, there still has to be a level of accountability. And we, the people, have a voice, and we have a responsibility to make that voice heard. And she gets to that. I mean, her grandma went to D.C. and marched.
Right.
My mother-in-law was up there. And so, you know, she gets to see that as well.
Well, you know, you've done one session now, you know, a couple of years now in the legislature. How has it been logistically for you, you know, making the travel and, you know, the low pay? I mean, it's tough, I know. So what's it been like for you and your family?
It's been tough. A few weeks ago, I was kind of getting like my suits ready to go to Raleigh. And my daughter said, she actually started crying a little bit and said, I see what you're doing and I know what this means. And she's like, it means, you know, dad's not going to be around. And we spend a lot of time on the weekends together. But I think what she misses a lot and I miss too, it's that casual, everyday, after school, dinner time kind of connection.
Yeah, downtime.
Yeah. And it's where those little snippets of information about your child you learn because you're there. So that's always a challenge. The 4-hour drive back and forth every week it wears on you. Sometimes I mix it up and I'll go 64 because 40 just is a nightmare sometimes.
Oh yeah.
But I'm glad I'm doing it. I'm glad that I've been entrusted with this responsibility. And I think that anybody who's thinking about running for office, it's almost like they should try it for a week or 2 weeks. Go down to Raleigh, spend a week down there, spend 2 weeks down there, drive back and forth, take some of the phone calls, look at some of the emails I get, visit some of the community folks. You know, it's not glamorous, but I didn't expect it to be. I don't expect anyone to feel sorry for me for doing it. I asked to do it, and I enjoy doing it for now. But, you know, there probably will come a time where, you know, I want to focus more on family.
Yeah. Well, Representative Turner, we've talked an hour. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you think we should?
I just want people to stay engaged and to engage outside their comfort zone. And if anyone wants to sit down, talk with me, you know, they call me, email me. I'll sit down with anybody, talk about just about anything. You know, I just want to be there for folks. And I want people to understand I'm a resource for them and they can use me.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Brian Turner. It's always great to have you.
Thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate it, man.
All right.